Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
I'm Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with our co-host, attorney at law, and today is April 7, 2011. Thank you to our hundreds of listeners. We get lots of downloads of our shows, and in addition, we have Greg Glazer, a specialist in constitutional law, with us the first Thursday of each month. So we're really excited to get started today, and I love starting the show with your song, Alan. It just puts me in a good mood to talk about all of these really important issues in our lives.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, of course.
Yeah, I really love that song. Each of the shows start up with a different kind of a melody and a feeling toward it. And every time that organic gardening show starts with a soft violin music, it's not as energetic to me as what you've got. You know? But anyway, Greg Glazer is an independent constitutional lawyer in Danville, California, with research published regularly at logicalhierarchy.com. He talks about constitutional law, and he does research and analysis of forced vaccinations during a declaration of martial law, war, outbreak, and pandemic. These are topics that you're really interested in, I presume. And so we're going to learn a lot today about the actual legal issues. And he has also written a memorandum, which can be located on the PandemicResponseProject.com website. It is a comprehensive and authoritative information about vaccine exemptions you can find from Alan Phillips, attorney at law, a leading vaccine rights attorney with years of experience helping clients legally avoid vaccines in a wide variety of vaccine refusal settings. And I can tell you that he has taught me so much during the months that we've been doing these shows every single week at the noon hour Eastern time. And it is critical for parents, students, immigrants, healthcare employees, military personnel and contractors, other agencies, other attorneys and clients, anyone who is interested in learning about exemptions and waivers for vaccines in the United States. Don't forget to push the friend button on the Blog Talk Radio show. We have a brand new design going up there. They have reformatted the pages. It looks pretty good. And you can also download the archives to listen at your convenience to the shows in your car, your iPod, your iTunes, or your computer. We have some news. I want to first say goodbye. We have a couple of guests over here in the chat also. So welcome. Okay, I hope you is sound going good, and you've got everybody can hear.
I'm hearing some glitches. It's cutting in and out, but that may just be
my hope connection. It's going to be improved. Okay, so we have had a lot of information dissemination through the Natural News website regarding North Carolina bill that has been up to the legislature and the change in wording that is being proposed. This is something that occurs on a frequent basis when to make minor changes, and it has had so much hype and so much attention that I have gotten numerous emails. I myself did call the Governor Perdue to state my opinion about, you know, the amendment. Is that what it is? It's an amendment to a bill? Bill 31?
Yes, yes, it is. It's really quite a simple bill, and it has been misunderstood, I think, by a lot of people in the alternative health community. So let me take just a quick minute here, if I may, to explain. I'll have the bill in front of me. It's all of 21 lines long, including the title, which is very short for a bill. Basically what it says, well, first of all, previously in the law, practicing medicine without a license here in North Carolina was a criminal violation and punishable as a Class 1 misdemeanor. And what this law does is to make that now a Class 1 felony. And by the way, Debbie, I checked the General Assembly webpage. It has now passed a third reading in both the House and the Senate as of today. And so my understanding then is that it merely awaits the governor's signature to be signed into law.
But I want to know the I want to know the implications of the changing of a few, like three words in there. Yeah.
Well, and there are some sentences, some other parts that have been reworded, but in effect, the bottom line is that what the bill does is to make the practice of medicine or surgery without a license now a Class 1 felony instead of a Class 1 misdemeanor. It does not have any language that addresses what constitutes practicing medicine or surgery without a license.
Right.
So alternative healthcare practitioners are no more vulnerable, at least technically speaking, to being accused of or being successfully prosecuted. In other words, the definitions haven't changed, only the penalty. Now, with it now being a Class 1 felony, does that mean possibly that prosecutors will give it more attention? For example, I have been told by local prosecutors here in Orange County, North Carolina, that even though a behavior may technically constitute a criminal violation, if it's something that has a stronger civil component to it, they won't take it on criminally. They'll tell you go find an attorney and file a lawsuit in criminal court. So they don't prosecute any and every behavior that constitutes technically a criminal by the laws on the books. And I suspect practicing medicine without a license would be taken seriously and pursued whether or not it were a felony. But the fact that it is a felony...
I think it's the way the setting that we're living in now with all of the threats to our freedoms and rights to get health care the way that we want it, access to vitamins, to supplements, to nutritionals, to homeopathy, all of these things. I think that the setting is very precarious. That's why when they make one little change, it is like a threat and it's kind of a fearful situation. So, for instance, surgery. Let's say you take a splinter out of your finger or something. Do you know when I went to have an eyelash, adjusted in my eye years ago, and I said, you're just using a finger, and she's just plucking out this eyelash, and the woman got very, very upset, and she said, no, I'm doing surgery. And so, I mean, it's just a simple real life experience, but truly, could we get in trouble for something as simple as this?
Well, the alternative practitioner community in and out of North Carolina is concerned over this, and I think that concern is warranted to some degree, not to the extent that this has been misportrayed as criminalizing alternative healthcare practice, because it isn't doing that. I guess the point is that if an alternative healthcare practitioner is in a gray area in terms of whether or not they are crossing definition lines in the statutes, that gray area just got a deeper shade of gray, so to speak, meaning that if there's any confusion or lack of clarity, if there's any ambiguity, if there's any basis for being accused of something, now the stakes have been raised. Now, I don't have the definition of practicing medicine in front of me, so I can't comment on that. Here in North Carolina, I'm sure the definition will have, you know, variations from state to state. But the bad news is, for those who are concerned about it, is it appears that the bill has passed both chambers and now awaiting only the governor to sign it into law. The good news is that there's a lot of hype that has been spread that's been really misportraying or misrepresenting what this bill actually does. So it's not as bad as a lot of the information out there says it is.
Okay, so do you think that people need to take any action?
Well, if they feel strongly about this bill, I think you could contact the governor and express your reasons why you would like her not to sign this into law. I don't have any insights into how that particular part of the process works or about this particular governor as opposed to the process I just described. But beyond that, I guess you would need to get in touch with folks who are more intimately acquainted with and experienced with the legislative process here. There certainly are some alternative health lobbyists in the state. So,
one of the issues you bring up is thing that we've spoken of in past shows, the broad wording of some legal document or bill or whatever in the Constitution can be then interpreted in different ways, or something that is narrowly defined. I kind of am going very much off of our regular scheduled topic, but I don't know, is this important to talk about?
Why don't we come back to that at a near future time, and I'd be glad to do that. I would rather have the definition in front of me and be able to talk about it in some detail about where the wording does or does not appear to have any lack of clarity. And that would be, it would be first and foremost in any ambiguity or lack of clarity, if there is any, in the definitions, where the alternative health care practitioners would need to be concerned.
I was just asking in terms of the legislature, how a legal attorney would look at, is it better to have something that broadly more ambiguous as opposed to having something that is so narrowly defined that you can't, there's no wiggle room? I guess that was my question. But if you want to put this, table this and get on to the regular scheduled agenda here, we can do that.
Oh, I want to take as much advantage as we can of Greg's presence here.
You know,
maybe he has something to chime in
to this question on the constitutionality of legislation that tries to take away the right to heal someone. There's a case called Butchers Union Company versus Crescent City Company. It's a United States Supreme Court case. And there's a famous saying, it's, the right to follow any of the common occupations of life is an inalienable right. So, yeah, they're going to try to enforce that law against probably practices that are very, very open and prominent in the community. Yeah. And it's going to be against this idea because even though there is a right to heal, there is also a long list of cases and doctrines and statutes that have come forward that have licensed occupations of common right. And so these issues have always been at a in battle. And you can find a rich history of case law that interprets people challenging these rules in all sorts of occupations, whether it was contractors or accountants or attorneys who've been regulated, and then also, of course, in the medical profession as well. And so, I would definitely think that would be a great topic to bring up for another show where Alan in particular and I can go over some of these explanations to give guidance on this very important point. Because if you can't heal another person, if they're going to make a law against that, then that is something worth standing up for.
Oh, sounds good. Okay, let's put that on the next on the agenda. And NACA versus Massachusetts case, you really want to discuss today?
Yeah, the case of Jacobson versus Massachusetts is a case about due process and whether the government can require vaccination. And the case came out of the state of Massachusetts, and essentially there was a preacher and his son in Cambridge, and they were very much opposed to vaccination and had a great argument for why it was not helpful to vaccinate. And this was actually the smallpox vaccination. And the government of the local government in Cambridge passed a law which said that you had to pay $5 if you didn't take the vaccination. And so they challenged this law.
So this was back in 1905. I just want to throw that in. $5 was a lot more then.
Oh, right.
Right. Yeah, 1905.
I did omit that one,
yeah.
And so they challenged this law and went all the way up to the Supreme Court of Massachusetts, and they just lost at every corner. And then the Supreme Court affirmed as well, saying that the government has this right under the police power to pass this particular law. And again, this law was only a fine. It wasn't a forced needle, you know. And this preacher and his son, they could leave the jurisdiction if they wanted to. And that was the great point of the case, that the public, this particular local government, has this local right through what's called the police power to make this rule in the best interests of the public. And the court even went so far as to say, even if the legislature was wrong and this is not in the best interest of the public, it doesn't matter. It's not the court's job to insert its own judgment, or it's not the individual person's right to insert their own judgment, but rather it's the public's right. So it was this great debate over the right of the public versus the right of the individual. So it's very much about liberty and the republic and where does the court draw the line of liberty, which is one of our questions for today.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like because this was making a person have to pay a fine, perhaps people who were not wealthy and couldn't afford to pay the fine, which made it less of a freedom for them to select to pay it.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's an underlying current as well.
Mm-hmm.
That point never came up in the case in particular.
The case, though, it does address, I tell you, it's such a dense case for me anyway. I can go back to it and see more every time I read through it. And it is a case that is referred to throughout the history of vaccination since that case as a basis for a lot of current vaccination policy. And there are some interesting points, I think, that bear discussing with regard to that. For example, people argue that the Jacobson case dealt with a local epidemic, a state of emergency. And the law was saying, the law, if I have this correct, was that the health department can require. In fact, one of the things that I think the case did do for us, whether we like it or the particular result or not, was to help us find the boundary of how far we can go in requiring just anybody to get a vaccine before we cross constitutional boundaries. And Jacobson had a really good reason for not wanting to be vaccinated. He had had a serious reaction to the smallpox vaccination as a child, and he didn't want to go through that again. And as I read the case, and Greg, let me know if you agree on this, the court came away saying that you could not legitimately force vaccination on someone who had a present medical condition, and perhaps having to have a medical doctor who is validating that fact, that presently right now you would have to be an unfit subject for vaccination. That is, the vaccine would have to pose a serious risk of harm or death for you to be able, in the face of an epidemic, to say, I don't want to do this, and I have a constitutional right to refuse it. And we have medical exemptions in every context in which vaccines are required. Actually, not literally every context. I have seen a couple of laws, and there may be more, that actually throw medical exemptions out the window to one degree or another in the context of a declared emergency, and maybe we can address that a little bit separately. I see those laws as stepping over the boundaries of Jacobson. In other words, those laws, in one case a regulation, I believe, would not hold up to constitutional scrutiny under Jacobson. But as to routine immunizations, in any event, we have medical exemptions everywhere, and I think Jacobson is probably the reason for that.
I think that makes a lot of sense. The case of Jacobson was a case that is so seminal in the sense that it has been quoted like no other case on this topic, because there is no other case on this topic that is so prominent. And in fact the court has never revisited this particular issue, and so it's cited in particular. The ones who really like this case are the military likes this case. Pharmaceutical companies like this case because it stands for the proposition that the public can pass laws requiring these measures, and what these measures are, vaccination, public health programs, that funds the big ag industry, and it also further supports the idea that the military can step in domestically and enforce these particular rules. But all the same, there are all of these gems inside the Jacobson opinion which uphold the right of liberty. And it's almost like the case was written by a judge with a dual personality, or like he was writing part of it, when he was at work, and then the other part when he was drinking scotch with his buddies or something. It's like it's self-contradictory, because in one sense he's saying that there is a natural law that no government may transcend, and then in another sense he says that a person can be compelled by force if need be against his will or even his religious or political conviction to take his place in the ranks of the army of his country, and just going into all these things that the government can do by force, and yet on one hand and at the same time saying the exact opposite, that there's liberty. And so in the process of being contradictory, the court sort of resolves that issue by saying that it's not prescribing an absolute rule on the issue of forced vaccination, or even the issue that Alan was talking about, where you could have a medical exemption for someone who had like a previous case of a negative reaction to a vaccine. And so it was just saying that for this particular smallpox program of Cambridge, Massachusetts in 1905, we're going to uphold this particular rule. And the rest of the case is primarily just what lawyers call dicta. It's just meant to be useful in future analysis and not controlling law. And that often gets overlooked by scholars, and certainly overlooked by the United States military and the apparatuses of public health programs today, in particular the CDC. A lot of big cases also has to be brought up in the context of the era. Smallpox, it was a great fear of smallpox in that particular time. You just Google smallpox images, you can see why there was this immense fear. It's a virus, a viral disease that basically comes from whether it's like bad hygiene, bad eating practices, and it's contagious at certain times. Like if your fever, if you have a temperature over 101, it starts to become contagious, though there's some debate on that. And it's a poison that's trying to release itself out of your body, sort of just cover you in marks. And so, if you saw someone with smallpox, you'd probably be like, oh my gosh, this must be the most contagious thing. I got to get rid of this thing. And so much of the public health programs of the past were responses to these diseases that really carried themselves out through a lot of problems that aren't as commonplace today. Like they can be aggravated by poor hygiene, poor diet, and whatnot. And so,
you're just a huge program about the smallpox vaccine. I was really surprised that the person, I don't have all the details, you have to look it up and find it for you, that even though his own child had a bad reaction from a vaccination, he still was a proponent and advocate of having vaccinations, even though he almost lost his own child. And I found that very personally disturbing for some reason. His just came out of nowhere. It defied like what you're saying. It's too contradictory in its final outcome. And so I'm wondering about what the interplay between the contradictory or statements that are being proposed here. Anybody hear me?
Yeah. Some of that broke up, but I think I got the gist of it. Edward Jenner, whose son had smallpox. And then there's a great article about this topic with a foreword by Leonard Horowitz, and the article is by Vivian Vetrano. And it talks about smallpox and the history and where where natural health is the remedy. And, you know, it's obviously this is going to be a common theme throughout vaccination. If, you know, for anyone who's done any research on the matter and hasn't been unduly persuaded by the powers that be, that all diseases can be cured through natural mechanisms, and diseases can also be aggravated by unnatural living. And so it's sort of just trying to work this balance of managing fear and managing natural remedies. And, you know, the process of employing natural remedies is exactly that. It is a process. And so in that process, some people will, you know, have aggravated, their conditions will worsen, some will die and whatnot. But on the balance of public health programs, what do people want to do? You know, are they going to go with the modern approach of vaccination, or are they going to go with the natural health approach? And so what the Jacobson case was getting at was the individual doesn't get to decide that question, that you don't have liberty to decide that question because it's a public health question. So if they tell you have to get vaccinated, then there you go. And so that's why Jacobson is so important and so dangerous. It's a question of liberty.
I'd like to, if I may, Greg, to take you back to you're making a distinction between what's the actual holding in a case, what's the part of a case that is the law in terms of actual precedent, and as I understand it, legal authorities may not even always agree on that. Sometimes they'll talk about the narrow holding or a broader holding in a case. But there's a portion that the Jacobson case in one part of the opinion goes in great detail talking about the wonderful successes of vaccination, and they acknowledge that there are some small percentage of physicians, quote, of great skill and repute, who do not believe that vaccination is a prevention of smallpox, but they fall back on that the common belief is that it has a decided tendency to prevent the spread of this fearful disease, to quote the opinion. But there's one sentence in particular here, and it says, a common belief, like common knowledge. Now, in this sentence out of the opinion, they're, of course, referring to the widespread belief, which is still largely the case, of course, today with vaccines generally. A common belief, like common knowledge, does not require evidence to establish its existence, but may be acted upon without proof by the legislature and the courts. And I tell you, I have great difficulty with that statement, and even though that's, I'm sure, part of the dicta.
They were actually citing a different case, in that. That's a quote from a different case. That was inside of the – they were citing a Court of Appeals of New York that made that particular point. But they were using it to support the greater point. So, yeah, that would be a classic case of dicta.
But here's the point, though. What it suggests is that for purposes of modern times, whoever controls the media controls not only people's beliefs, but thereby controls the law. The idea that the courts or the legislature, for example, based on nothing more than just the widely held belief that vaccines are safe, effective, and necessary, or sufficiently safe and effective to be necessary, that they don't even have to address the science or any alternative science to be able to enact a law requiring it, and then everybody has to abide by that law unless they qualify for some available exemption. It's a rather disturbing. And I think the point I guess I want to get to is the underlying belief. Because this case has been cited, Jacobson has been cited in subsequent cases and as recently as a case out of the Fourth Circuit just a couple of weeks ago, as not being limited to its facts as they pertain to an emergency situation, but that in fact the case is said by district and at least one district and circuit court, and I say this, the Fourth Circuit, case from a couple of weeks ago or the end of March, and that case cites Jacobson and a federal district court case out of Arkansas back in 2002, which says that the Supreme Court did not limit its holding in Jacobson to diseases presenting a clear and present danger. Did you get that reading out of Jacobson, and do you think this is an accurate assertion by the Fourth Circuit that the Supreme Court did not limit its holding in Jacobson to diseases presenting a clear and present danger? Because I came away from Jacobson feeling that, well, this is talking about an emergency situation, and therefore it's a bit of a stretch to necessarily apply Jacobson to routine immunizations as opposed to emergency vaccines only. What are your thoughts on that, Craig?
Yeah, I think that the Jacobson case used the word epidemic to describe the smallpox problem. But in the same sense, they also only applied a test of rational basis of the police power, which is a special test applied to fundamental rights. So I would say that that the case should only apply to smallpox in 1905. And that it is useful to describing the role of the public health and public safety in setting constitutionality for regulations and laws, but whether or not it's exclusively relating to issues of clear and present danger, if that were the holding, it certainly would have been more clear in the case. So I would say that circuit court in not limiting it to cases of clear and present danger was correct.
So in a way, I'm getting a reverberation. Okay, so what you're saying, Greg, is that that question I had earlier about the broadly worded type of legal document and something that is very narrow. So you're saying that you can pinpoint this is specifically dealing with the smallpox disease and not just in general all different diseases, all other contagious diseases.
No, I mean I think that that there's room for argument on both sides. I think that the military industrial complex is currently succeeding in applying Jacobson across the board, and that if I were the attorney presenting the case on behalf of a client today who didn't want vaccination, I would probably lose because of the rich history of applying this particular case. I mean, to try to limit this to 1905 smallpox would be tough, even though the court is explicitly stating that it's not trying to apply an absolute rule in all cases, and that is it is explicitly applying its rule only to this particular regulation at hand. But in the process of applying it only to the particular regulation at hand, it can grow through other cases, and I think that's probably what has happened. And so Yeah.
Right. Historically, it has set a new precedent.
Yeah. Jacobson has set a precedent, a very dangerous one. And even though technically there are all of these issues with it, where you could say that it doesn't apply because they acknowledge natural law as trumping the public health, you could you can't interpret it too broadly without causing unintentional consequences. Like, for example, separation of powers. If you give the legislature the absolute right to force vaccination on someone, that's an absolute power over the human body that you cannot control. That's completely unconstitutional. Like, that has no it lacks checks and balances. It's, again, a form of absolute power, is the total abrogation of due process and liberty. So you can't interpret it too broadly. And the court used an outdated test, it was the rational basis test. But if you're infringing on someone's medical liberty, then you have to apply a stricter – the court is supposed to apply a stricter test. Like, they can't just say, oh, well, was the Massachusetts legislature reasonable in enacting this? They have to say, no, was this absolutely necessary to curb smallpox? That would be a stricter test. Or they might apply like a middle-of-the-ground test. But they shouldn't apply the simplest test, which is the one that I had mentioned about 10 minutes ago, where the court was saying that even if the legislature was logically wrong, or even if the plaintiff, the preacher, had a bunch of evidence that vaccines were harmful, it wouldn't change the case. If you applied a different legal test where you have to show that this law was necessary to curb smallpox, then it is very much relevant whether or not vaccines cause harm. So this procedural issue of what test to apply would be huge in any case. In fact, you would spend probably the bulk of your legal brief just getting to that, just to get the right test. Because if you did, and you could open the door to all of that evidence, oh, you're going to win in front of a jury. Give me 12 rational people where I can talk about the military-industrial complex without getting my evidence excluded, and I have about 3 weeks to do it, and I think I can win this case. But could you even realistically get to that point? You'd have to have a I mean, you could really realistically get to that point. Perhaps it's surprising that it hasn't happened yet.
Right.
We'll call on you when we get that case, Greg.
All right.
Yeah, definitely. You're on our cell phone, automatic dial-up. Just to interject here, that NPR show was on Fresh Air on April 5th, 2011. It was called Pox in American History. It was by Will Rich, who was an historian, and what was he was being asked what he thinks about the vaccine policy in the United States, and he states that in his opinion, in the wake of the discrediting, so he still stands by the discrediting of Andy Wakefield's study, which is now, I don't think, stands. But that's what he's basing it on. So people are just holding on to their own personal opinion on this stuff, I think. And he also goes into the issue of herd immunity. But he was the gentleman whose son was damaged by the rotavirus vaccine and almost died from intussusception. But he still comes out saying, I'm good to go for vaccines. I don't know why, but that was his conclusion. So refresh again what we've covered today in this case of the Jacobson versus Massachusetts of 1905, was it?
Yes. The case says that in the event you have a law that requires vaccination or imposes a penalty for failure to vaccinate, then the courts will apply due process to examine whether or not the legislature properly exercised the police power to protect the public health. And the standard used for police power regulation to see whether it's constitutional is simply whether it's rational, and virtually all laws will pass that test. As irrational as it may seem to a free-thinking individual, that word rational, when used in courts, just means is it nonsense, or is it anything above nonsense?
And let me throw a point in on that, if I may, Greg, because I'd like your input on this. I tell people, I see this in particular in what I refer to as the vaccine custody disputes, where parents agree not to vaccinate until they split up, and then one of them decides to go pro-vaccine because they think they can make the other one look like a fruitcake and they can get custody. And the pro-exemption parent wants to grab the first alternative medical doctor they can find who will get on the stand and talk about all the problems with vaccines. And I tell them, look, you can't win that, and the reason is this, that courts cannot second-guess the state legislatures. And, in fact, I think Jacobson tells us that. And the state legislature is presumed to have considered the merits and any problems with vaccines when they made the decision to enact the mandates. And so the courts arguably don't even have authority, in my opinion, to consider whether or not vaccines are harmful. The place for us to take that issue, if we disagree that vaccines are reasonably safe and effective, is to take our medical information back to the state legislature and say, you guys got it wrong, here's why, let's fix the law. But even if you could...
That way, in a republic, though, you have the individual right, and so one man with the right can change the entire law. But in cases where they apply that rational basis test, the standard is so low that they will just say, "Oh well, we're going to presume that the legislature examined all of these things." But when it's an issue of medical liberty, they're supposed to employ the deeper test, as they did in like case like 1974 Cruzan versus Missouri. But the Jacobson used the outdated test from 1905. And so theoretically it shouldn't apply, but that does not stop the military industrial complex today from oversighting Jacobson, because they have
So I have two questions there then. Let me push forward to get a clear answer on at least my first question, and then I'll pass the baton to you. I think that there's a legislative presumption, not saying I personally agree with it, but that there's a legislative presumption when you're talking about a vaccine law, a vaccine mandate, that the vaccines are sufficiently safe and effective, and that the courts cannot try to analyze scientific evidence to decide whether or not the legislature got it right. And therefore, that there's an argument to be made, at least, that the courts don't even have that authority. But and so I wonder if you agree or disagree with that. But the second point then is that even if the courts can address that question, it's a lost cause, because courts look at the weight of the evidence, and you're going to see the majority of doctors and the state and federal health authorities on the whole support vaccination, and so the weight of the evidence is in favor of it, regardless of what somebody's view of the so-called alternative science might be. So,
right, yeah, you're right.
Yeah. I have a question.
And also, there's even this point from Jacobson, I'll just quote it exactly, where the court says, and this is just an excerpt, so try not to take this out of context, but it says, "No court, much less a jury, is justified in disregarding the action of the legislature." You know, just that little excerpt right there shows you that the judge who wrote this case, you know, the same judge who said, "Oh, of course they can ship you off to war regardless of the merits of the war," even mentions that, regardless of the merits of the war. It's this idea of liberty. I mean, to what extent can they is the public good, or the public as perceived by the legislature, so infallible as it cannot be challenged? And what this judge is saying, no court, much less a jury. Like, are you catching that? How he's scoffing at a jury? You know, he's putting the courts above juries, and even then he's putting the legislature above the courts. And why? Why? I mean, it's just based on this judge's preconceived notions of what a democracy should be. And this is supposed to be
and on preconceived notions about the effectiveness and necessity of vaccines, frankly.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I was on my high horse there. I was talking about how I could win that case, right? Now, even if I won that case, it could go before some low-level appellate court, and they could just strike it, and I could appeal, and maybe the Supreme Court wouldn't even grant cert so that they would even review it, you know? And then it would just fall into obscurity. So the system is set up to provide process, due process, not perfect process, sometimes failed process. And that's our new world order.
My question has to do with definitions. I mean, this particular case that is being cited and used as precedent over and over again historically over the decades is talking about something that is completely different than it is today. Based on the information that was given by the historian about smallpox and about vaccinations, that particular process or a matter or a medical procedure was done with scraped pox discharge, and scrape your arm and put it on your arm, and that is a vaccine. Today, a vaccine is composed of hundreds of other kinds of materials that were not the definition itself of a vaccine, I would say, would have to be redefined.
Well, and of course, we have many, 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 many more vaccines that are being given. And so to look to use Jacobson, which is looking at a single vaccine and or vaccination in isolation in the context of an outbreak or epidemic, to try to compare that situation with a situation today where, as you point out, the vaccines are completely different, have a whole long list of other toxic ingredients in them, and are given over and over again, multiple vaccines and multiple doses of some of the same vaccines, it is astronomically different situation. And you raise a profound point there, Debbie, and we don't hear people who raise Jacobson to support vaccination as mentioning that enormous detail that you've brought forth.
Right. I'm saying that when we speak, when we use the term vaccination, we're talking a whole new ball of wax. We're talking about a whole new animal. It is not the same thing as what they were talking about then.
Yeah, yeah. Like the Native Americans would take a little poison ivy or poison oak, you know, and they might put a little bit under their lip to kind of, you know, get themselves used to it so they wouldn't get rashes. I mean, that's traditional vaccination. You know, what's happening today with all of these, I think it's called adjuvants, and
right.
all of these poisons that are put in it. I mean, I think you hit the nail right on the head. This needs a different word.
Yes. That's what I'm saying. So you have to have a whole new look at this particular, what you're using as the basis for your legal actions and your laws.
The three terms, inoculation, vaccination, and immunization, for legal purposes, as far as I can tell, are interchangeable words. We see a lot of people object to the word immunization because they say vaccines don't truly immunize, and so some people in the alternative community object to the use of that word at all. For my purposes, in any sort of legal assessment or assertion, I believe the words are pretty much interchangeable. The way they're defined, the way that terms are defined generally are going to vary with each jurisdiction that is using them. In other words, each state law is going to have its own definitions that may or may not be the exact same terms or exact same definitions as other states. And part of the difficulty with this issue legally is that a good percentage, if not the vast majority, of vaccine laws are state laws. And we have 50 states and another 5 or 6 or 7, however many territories, and then there's different federal context, immigration, military, et cetera. So there are many, many different opportunities for the words to be defined or used with subtle or even not so subtle differences. Adds to the confusion, of course, potentially.
Okay, would you like to take what you were speaking about a little bit earlier, what is due process, and apply it to this case before our time is up for today?
Sure, yeah. Due process protects the individual's right to life and liberty, and also it promotes a process for managing that those substantive underlying rights. And so what due process is it's another way to say fairness, to protect rights. And the court in Jacobson says, and I'll quote one sentence, "Even liberty itself, the greatest of all rights, is not unrestricted license to act according to one's own will." And then the court says, existence. It is only freedom from restraint under conditions essential to the equal enjoyment of the same right by others. Okay, so what due process is it's the mechanism that we're going to recognize liberty, but manage it in balance with the rights of others. And that would also include, of course, the public as a whole, as represented by the government and its agencies. And so this case dealt with one particular local government applying their particular local rule that infringed liberty. And the court came across recognizing liberty. You know, it had to go through all of that. You know, here we find this right, it does exist, and then limiting it, saying, well, it exists, but it's not unrestricted. This is the process that we'll use. You're in court. This is an error to the Supreme Court of the state of Massachusetts. You know, there's your process. And then the last question, what is due? What is fair? So the court, you know, goes through this whole analysis, and much of it is based on the right of the legislature to take in all of the information and set this rule. And this judge who wrote this opinion said, I don't want a jury deciding it. I don't even want a judge deciding it. This is a case for the legislature because it's a public health issue. And so that's dangerous because that's not our public. The right to your body, the right to prevent, you know, a needle from going into you should be an absolute fundamental right if you're being natural, because there's no way to avoid it other than leaving the jurisdiction. Once they can, you know, chip you or vaccinate you and you lack the ability to be natural, that's an absolute power over the human body. That is fundamentally wrong and immoral. And that is the danger of misapplying Jacobson. This case is so important. And yet, I just can only imagine the percentage of the population, even informed people who deal with these issues, that have actually read this case.
You know what? This is very, very interesting, because the technology today, the medical technology, is going beyond what you just said. The chip and the vaccine and the injection, they're going into a nasal inhalant, they're going into nanoparticles that can just be rubbed on you, they're going into food, all of these different modes of going beyond your boundary, your physical boundary, is becoming so subtle that it's not going to be something that you can see with your eye almost. You know, it's going to be happening out there, or to individuals without, maybe, I don't want to say without their knowledge, but perhaps, you know, this is kind of scary. I don't know.
Well, let me jump in here real quick if I can, because I see time's getting short here, about what I think we need to do about all of this. I think that I'm going to play devil's advocate here in a sense for a little bit. I think Jacobson makes perfect sense given the premises that it's based on, and in particular I mean that vaccines are the cause of substantial disease decline. You know, Neil Miller's first book, Vaccines, Are They Really Safe and Effective?, has a graph showing the decline of smallpox from the late 1800s across the first decade or two into the 1900s. And there also has a graph showing the decline in vaccination, and there's a direct correlation between the two, suggesting that, and he concludes, and it's a reasonable conclusion from his data, that smallpox declined when people started refusing the vaccines, because there's a direct correlation of the two declining together. But I think our current vaccine policy, as well as the ruling in Jacobson over 100 years ago, was based on the premise that vaccines are the reason that we have the low disease rates we have today compared to prior years. That is, that vaccines actually work. And I think, because, see, none of us wants, and I always use the extreme case to make the point, you know, the serial killer should not be able to claim a constitutional right so that he can keep on killing. I mean, there are few, if any, unbounded rights, and it's absolutely appropriate for someone, and I suppose in our current system that would be the government, to be saying we have to draw boundaries somewhere on people's rights to act unilaterally when it begins to create a problem for the rest of society and to harm other people. Well, if you accept that initial premise that vaccines are effective And for purposes of today, that vaccines are what have caused the declines of disease in the 1900s, then it makes sense to require them, even though there may be some harm from them. The problem is that there's substantial data that just directly contradicts that underlying premise. And I think we're not going to be able to overturn Jacobson either by new statutory law or by a case, another Supreme Court case someday in the future, unless and until we can successfully attack that underlying premise. And Neil Miller, among others, I'll give him a little praise again, went out and did the research and showed that it varies from disease to disease and vaccine to vaccine, but on the whole, somewhere on the order of 85 or 90% of disease decline, infectious childhood infectious disease decline in the 1900s preceded vaccines. In fact, in my own research, I found out that Dr. Bernard Greenberg right here at the University of North Carolina, or from the University of North Carolina in 1961, testified before Congress that polio, which we did have epidemics in the late 40s and early 50s, but polio actually had been on a decline for 3 to 5 years before the first polio vaccine was introduced. When that vaccine was introduced, it actually reversed pre-existing declines, and health authorities changed the definitions of what counts as polio and what counts as polio paralysis. So on paper, polio went down, and that was a deliberate and complete cover-up of what was actually a disaster vaccine to save face and panic and who knows what all might have happened, because people were legitimately very much afraid of polio. But our entire policy is based on some lies, is the point. And when we can bring that information out and get some validity to that, then I think this whole, everything that's built on top of this false premise will necessarily have to crumble.
Yeah. You have a minute. Greg,
yeah,
do you want to finish the show?
Pardon?
Do you want to finish? Have 1 minute.
You get the last word, Greg.
All right. It's the premise that you're naming is the battle between logic and power. And are we going to recognize that there is a logical basis to reject vaccines and do this research, or are we just going to defer to the power of those who are exercising it in a public health perspective? And I think that logic generally does great, except when people are very fearful. And that's where the media will come in and step in and support the military-industrial complex to make that last push. And I think there's a storm coming, and it's going to involve the disease and vaccines and quarantines and all of that. So time to prepare.
Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to the next show with you, because I think we can continue and finish up this really lively discussion. Also, I want to thank Alan for being with us and always having good questions and good answers. So I'm going to end the show and see you, that's May. Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Good night.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brockbrock on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Share your life. Your truth be a girl.